Okay, so welcome back, everybody. Remember where we are in the course. We spent weeks and weeks developing the math to describe curved space times. And then, now we are ready to study, on one hand, how the curvature of space time is affecting the motion of matter. This is what we did in the previous lecture. We studied the Maxwell equation, the Dirac equation, and so on a background of curved space time. Now, we are aiming to find out how matter is affecting space-time. And matter is affecting space-time indirectly. Matter is creating energy and momentum. Wherever there's matter, there's energy and there's momentum. And it is that matter, it is that energy and momentum that is curving space. So what we will do in this lecture today is study energy and momentum in general relativity. So we study how the various matter fields produce energy densities and momentum densities, so that then in the next lectures we can study how that translates into curvature. Now remember that in flat space-time, that is in Minkowski space, the invariance of the action under translations in time and translations in space, the time and space translation symmetry, implies conservation laws. It implies the conservation of energy and the conservation of momentum. It's one of the deepest insights in physics ever, that symmetries translate into conservation laws. That's due to Emmy Noether, who proved in very large generality that whenever there's a symmetry, a continuous symmetry, by the way, it's important that it's a continuous symmetry, whenever there's a continuous symmetry, such as a translation or rotation symmetry, Hoost symmetry, then there is a corresponding conservation law. Ultimately, it goes very deep. It goes back to your primary school days, when you were calculating things like text problems, like a farmer has so many cows and they produce this much milk per day and the milk costs that much on the market and therefore per month this farmer is making this much money. And if you are just supposed to calculate that, how do you do this? Well, you take every sentence of the text and translate it into an equation. And then these equations you solve, right? And there is this general principle that whatever statement you make in physics, ultimately, it corresponds to some equation. And what Emmy Noether found out is that the statement that the laws of nature are invariant under time translation, whether you do an experiment now or later, makes no difference, translates into a mathematical equation, which is energy is conserved. Right? It's just like with the farmers and the equations. It's a direct translation of that. And the fact that it doesn't matter where you do an experiment translates into the conservation of momentum, etc. Now, for fields, for physical fields, this means that at every point in space and time, energy and momentum can flow in and out of that point. But overall, they have to be conserved. I'm still talking about Minkowski space. Right? So for a particle that's moving around, we have that if there's no forces, there are no forces acting on it, then its energy and momentum will be conserved. If you have fields around, then it means that whatever amount of energy flows into a region also has to flow out of it again. And same for momentum, you have to have conservation of energy and momentum when you integrate it up over regions. Now, in curved space times, things are a little bit more complicated. And that's because it actually matters now where you do an experiment, because curved space can be curved. And it matters whether you perform an experiment on a curved space background or not. For example, if you do an experiment with laser beams, well, they get bent in curved space. Even though they travel as straight as possible, they actually bend. So the very same experiment performed here or performed somewhere where there's strong curvature might have a different outcome. So in a generic curved space-time, there is no translation invariance, neither in space nor in time, because curvature can change over time. In fact, curvature between space and space coordinates is what we have intuition for. But the curvature tensor involves also matrix elements between spatial and temporal coordinates, right? Between the zero component and the I component of the curvature tensor. Do you have any intuition for what curvature in space and time means as opposed to the regular space-space curvature? It means expansion or shrinkage. That's what it is. So we have intuition for that too. We just don't usually think of expansion or shrinkage as curvature. But it is curvature between space and time, as we will see later on in more detail. Okay, so what that means is that the fact that we don't have these translation invariances in space and time on a generic curved space-time, we have that the flows of energy and momentum will generally not be conserved. You see, ordinarily, when there are appeals to the general population, conserve energy, they can't help it. Everybody has to conserve energy. You can't waste it. It's conserved, right? It's the law of nature. But general relativity gets you out of it. You can make energy out of no energy, and vice versa, energy can just get lost. So the flows of energy and momentum will generally not be conserved. But still, flows of energy exist, and flows of momentum exist. But you see, now we can no longer identify energy as the quantity that is being conserved because of time translation invariance. We can no longer identify momentum as being that quantity which is conserved because of translation invariance. That's how you could identify energy and momentum in Minkowski space. But on curved space-time, cannot. Have to identify what energy and momentum is, even in circumstances where they are not conserved. So the idea, the basic idea here is the following. Whatever the quantities are that play the roles of energy and momentum in curved space-time, these quantities must be very sensitive to changes in curvature. Just felt like I was remotely toppling it. Because I was just doing like this when it toppled over. Okay, so whatever plays the role of energy and momentum in curved space-time must be very sensitive to any changes in the space-time geometry. Right? Because the very notion of what we think is energy, what we think is momentum, is tied to the notion of space-time. In Minkowski space, just a translation invariance. But in general, it has to be somehow tied to the geometry of space-time, even if it is not flat, even if it's not translation invariant. It must be tied to it. And therefore, it is useful to study how the action of our theories, the action of the Klein-Gordon field, the action of electromagnetism, the action of whatever field we want, whatever system we consider, how that action changes as we change the geometry. Okay? Just, let me just remind you why the action comes into this. Noether's principle says that if the action does not change under a continuous transformation, such as translation in space and time, you can then derive from that a conservation law. So the action is central in this. So therefore, let us look at how the action changes as we change the geometry. So let us vary the action with respect to the metric. This, by the way, is a non-trivial business. Let's keep this in mind for later. By differentiating the action with respect to the metric, we are calculating the change of the action as we change the curvature of space-time, as we change the metric. But we are also calculating, along with that, the change of the action when we don't change the space-time and we only change the coordinate system. You see, there are two ways that in which you can change the metric g mu nu of x. You can actually change the space-time, that will change the g mu of x. But you can also leave the space-time the same and just change coordinate system. that will also make the numerical coefficients in Jimmy Neu of x different, right? Both of these things change Jimmy Neu. And we are now calculating the change of the action with respect to the metric. Why don't we just differentiate with respect to the geometric degrees of freedom? Well, because it's hard. It's hard to separate the mere changes of coordinates from the actual changes of geometry. If the program of spectral geometry, for example, that I talked about some lectures ago, was to be complete, if that were complete, we could do this. We could differentiate the action with respect to the eigenvalues of some scalar operators, and then we would not face the problem that we are doing two differentiations at the same time. We're differentiating here with respect to changes of geometry and with respect to changes of the coordinate system. Both of these are important, and we will have to separate the two out later on. Okay, but for now, let's just calculate how the action changes, or let's just consider how the action changes as we change the metric. And since we're differentiating with respect to a covariant symmetric 2 tensor, what we obtain is something that has two upper indices then. Actually, it's not a tensor. We will soon see what it actually is. But for now, let's just define it as a quantity that you obtain when you differentiate a scalar, the action, with respect to a covariant symmetric 2 tensor. Okay, so what do we mean by a deformation of the metric? A deformation of the metric is defined just the same way that we defined earlier, in the previous lecture, the deformation or the variation of a field. You know, the delta of psi that we defined last time. Now we are looking at deltas of g. A deformation of the metric is an extension of the metric. The metric is, to start with, g mu nu of x. But now we introduce an extra parameter in such a way that when the parameter is 0, we are getting back the metric with which we started. And when the parameter lambda is not 0, but is instead in some interval around 0, then the metric is different from starting metric, except it's only different inside a certain bubble in space-time, inside a certain region B. And outside that region, so in the among the space-time points that are in the manifold, except for that bubble, the deformation doesn't do anything. And for any value of lambda, we just have the original metric. And then we write that the variation of g, which is a symbolic expression, actually means the ordinary derivative of the metric in which we now have a deformation parameter with respect to that deformation parameter at lambda equal to 0. And again, let's keep in mind that these variations are mathematically simply modifications of this matrix-valued function g mu nu of x, modifications that depend on this parameter lambda, obeying this condition that they're only modifications inside that bubble. And for lambda equals 0, you get the original metric back. But physically, only some of these variations are actually changing the Riemannian structure, the actual shape of the manifold. And some of them will only be because of a change of coordinates. And then we say that the action is functionally differentiable, so we can do this variation with respect to g mu nu in this bubble or region B. If this expression, namely the ordinary derivative of the action with respect to the deformation parameter at lambda equals 0, exists for all smooth deformations of g. So for all infinitely many times differentiable deformations of g. So we want this to exist, this derivative to exist, and to be of this form here, so that we give sense to this definition that we did earlier. See, in the previous slide, we said, let us consider how the action changes with g mu nu. So we wrote down tau mu nu is equal to ds by d g mu nu. Now we're making this explicit. So we say that the action is differentiable with respect to the metric if we can do these derivatives for all deformations of the metric that obey this. And if this expression then takes this form, where it's the integral over that bubble, because only in the bubble are we actually changing things. And then here we have this object tau mu nu, where, please don't think of the torsion when you see that. It's a tau again, but nothing to do with the torsion. And then multiplied with the variation being this expression here, d4x. We could add here an anti-symmetric part, any anti-symmetric part, but it would drop out because the variation of g mu is symmetric. So this is in principle only fixed up to the addition of an anti-symmetric part, which we by convention drop. Okay, and then if this all exists, then we say that the functional derivative of S with respect to the metric, which is the quantity that we are interested in, it's how does the action react if we change the metric, if we change the shape of the manifold? Well, and if we change coordinates in some cases. This expression, whatever it might be, we call 1/2 of tau mu nu. The 1/2 is a convention factor that you will see why it arises in a moment. It has to do with the fact that this is symmetric, and then you get the same expression twice if you contract over the mu nu with something symmetric. Yeah, basically because of here, right? You get every expression twice here. You get the g12 and the t12, but you get also the t21 and the g21. Right? So you get these expressions twice. Okay. Now, the first thing to notice is that when we differentiate the action with respect to the metric tensor, then we obtain this capital tau thing, which is not a tensor. It's almost a tensor, but it's not quite. To see this, let us rewrite that integral. So by definition, we have that the tau is the quantity here that makes this equation true, which is it's the derivative of S of the action with respect to the variation of the metric. Now, let's rewrite that by inserting a square root of g here in order to get the volume form there. But then we have to undo this again, so we have to divide by 1 over g somewhere in this expression. So this is the same as that. We've just multiplied with square root of g and divided by square root of g. Since the metric is not degenerate, we can always do this. And now we can identify what we have. We have a volume form here. It's an n form. We need this in order to be able to integrate. But then the rest better be scalar. Now we know that this is a tensor. It's just a variation of a symmetric two tensor. And so therefore, that also has to be a tensor. So the whole thing is scalar. We know that because the action is scalar, and we're differentiating with respect to a scalar parameter. So therefore, this must be a scalar. This must be a tensor, right? This must be a symmetric contravariant two tensor, and that is a symmetric covariant two tensor. Okay, but if this is a tensor, then that thing alone cannot be. So what shall we call this then, if it's not a tensor? Well, any quantity that needs to be multiplied with a 1 over square root of g in order to become a tensor is called a tensor density. So for example, if capital M is a tensor, so manifold contravariant, so manifold covariant, then this expression here, obtained by taking the tensor and multiplying it with the square root of g that goes into the volume factor, that is a tensor density, right? Because if we take this thing and divide it by square root of g, then we obtain M, which is a tensor. So the general notation, the terminology is that any expression that when divided by square root of g becomes a tensor is called a tensor density. So tau mu nu is a tensor density. And if we then divide it by square root of g, let's give this thing a name. It's then t mu nu. And that thing is not simply the derivative of the action with respect to the metric, but we also have to divide by square root of g. That thing is called the energy momentum tensor. This is a tensor. But of course, at the moment, we can't quite see yet why this would have to be called the energy momentum tensor. So let's hold back with calling it that. Let's just call it T mu nu. It expresses the variation of the action with respect to variations of the metric and with respect to variations of the coordinate system. This tensor, T mu nu, obeys a super important equation, this one, which helped guide Einstein towards the right Einstein equation. And what we see here is that it almost looks like a conservation law. It almost looks like a divergence. If there were only one index like this, then it would be a divergence and we would have a conservation law, but it's not. It's this. It's also sometimes called covariant conservation, but you can't really get a conservation law from that alone. This does not mean that any particular quantity is actually conserved. It means something more subtle. Roughly speaking, what happens to Noether's theorem is that we have this freedom of choosing arbitrary coordinates. And we have this freedom of choosing how many arbitrary new coordinates? Well, n. If the manifold is n-dimensional, then we can have a free choice of a new x0 coordinate, free choice of a new x1 coordinate, x2, x3 coordinate, right? With n choices. And the theory is completely invariant under changing coordinate system, which is not a physical statement, it's a mathematical statement. Right, that we have complete invariance under changes of coordinates. And that one statement, that we can choose our n coordinates freely, and it doesn't change the theory. Again, just like these primary school examples of the farmer with the milk, right? These statements translate into mathematical equations. Like, I get to choose a new x0 tilde coordinate. I get to choose a new x1 coordinate, and it doesn't change the theory, right? Not a physical statement, a mathematical one, but still, it translates into an equation. And that's these equations, n of them. These are n equations. You sum over nu, but you have n values for mu free. That gives you n equations. And these n equations, as we will see in a moment, simply express the fact that you get to choose your coordinates as you want. This takes care of the fact that there is redundancy in that tensor. Redundancy in the sense that when we differentiate the action with respect to the metric, we are not really only differentiating with respect to the changes of shape in the manifold. We are also differentiating with respect to changes of coordinates, which is a redundant thing to do, because we're not actually changing the manifold. And that means there must be redundant information in this tensor T mu nu. And this redundancy is expressed in the fact that these equations hold no matter what. It doesn't depend on the physics of it. These equations hold no matter what. OK. I'm anticipating a lot of the things that we will do just a few slides further down. So at the moment, let's just let that statement stand here. We will prove it a little later. So what we need to do is to identify how T mu nu now actually relates to the flows of energy and the flows of momentum that are associated with matter fields. And for that, it helps to consider the situations where we still have conservation laws. Even on curved spacetimes, we can have conservation laws. Because whenever we can say, something doesn't change under such and such continuous operation, Noether's theorem kicks in and we get some conserved quantity, even if it's on curved spacetime. So let us consider the cases where our spacetime has a symmetry. For example, the spacetime might be in the form of some vase, which has a rotational symmetry. Now, let us look at a diffeomorphism phi that maps the manifold into the manifold such that the metric goes into numerically the same metric, so such that the pullback of the metric is the same metric again. You can always change coordinates, of course, but you can always change your coordinate system. But when you do, then over the origin of the coordinate system, for example, there may not have been curvature before, but after you rotate your coordinate system around, suddenly at the origin of the coordinate system, you may have curvature. The metric might be different here than it is over there, right? But if it's not, if under a diffeomorphism, the metric actually stays the same, that's an important thing, because then you can say the metric doesn't change if I change my coordinate system this way. If I rotate around, then the metric doesn't change. That's an important thing to say if it is true in a space-time. This is physical information. It says something about the shape of the space-time. Does it or does it not have a translation or a rotation symmetry? So let's assume we have space-time that happens to have some symmetry. So there is a diffeomorphism phi from the manifold into the manifold, such that the metric actually doesn't change under that. In the infinitesimal form, what it means is that, remember, the Lie derivative of the metric vanishes. Okay, so we expect the flows of energy or momentum to be conserved then. So in this case, we expect the conservation laws, and what is conserved is energy and momentum. So let us try to identify these flows by their conservation. And it suffices, as it does in Minkowski space, to look at the infinitesimal transformations. You don't have to look at finite translations to get the conservation law, just infinitesimal translation symmetry already gives us the conservation law. So on a space-time defined by a manifold with a metric, consider the infinitesimal flow induced by a vector field xi. Again, this is this vase, and this vector field points in the direction in which all the points move as we change as we do our map from the manifold into the manifold. Every point gets mapped into an infinitesimally neighboring point governed by this tangent vector field xi. So our diffeomorphism goes from the manifold into the manifold. Phi maps the point with coordinates x into the point with coordinate x mu plus psi mu. Then the fact that the metric doesn't change under the pullback that's induced by this diffeomorphism means that the Lie derivative of the metric vanishes, as I hope you remember. Now, any vector field xi, which in some region of the manifold obeys that the Lie derivative vanishes, which is to say that under infinitesimal diffeomorphisms generated by xi, the metric stays actually the same, is called a Killing vector field. How can we find Killing vector fields, if there are any? I mean, we should state clearly that space-time doesn't have any Killing vector field, right? And each one of us is responsible for that, because we curve space just by having a mass. And that destroys all sorts of symmetries, right? There's no rotation symmetry in the universe. There's no translation symmetry, and not in space or in time. Just because that would be the case even if only one of us existed and the rest of the universe was empty. So really, we don't have Killing vector fields. But in a very good approximation, we often have Killing vector fields. For example, even for black holes, we have a Killing vector field in time. For a Schwarzschild black hole, you know, it doesn't change over time. And so we have a symmetry there and conservation laws because of it and so on. So Killing vector fields only arise in idealizations, but they're important. Because remember that when we have conservation laws, it's just like in ordinary classical mechanics, this really helps in solving the equations of motion, because it reduces the number of differential equations that we have to solve. Now, how to find Killing vector fields? Well, remember, this means we have to find metrics whose we have, no, sorry, the metric is given. We have to find vector fields xi such that the Lie derivative of the metric in the direction of xi is vanishing. Now, let's remember something about the Lie derivative. The Lie derivative of a tensor is given by this expression. And I said remember, but I have to say there are semicolons here. You've seen this equation before, but with comma. When we first defined the Lie derivative, we didn't even have the affine connection. Right? You can define the Lie derivative without knowing about metrics or affine connections. Now, when we first defined the Lie derivative, it was this expression here, where we had the ordinary derivative, just a comma there, and then we had the ordinary derivatives of not just the tensor here, but also the derivatives of the direction vector field. And now we are claiming, hey, this equation is also true when we put semicolons there, which is not trivial, because we are introducing Christoffel symbol terms now by putting the semicolon. And it's still true. And the reason is the same reason that we encountered a few times before. If you have an equation that is true with commas, with ordinary partial derivatives, then it's also true with the semicolon, with the covariant derivatives. And you can easily see why that is. Just pick a point of the manifold, choose Riemann normal coordinates around that point. Then we know the equation is true for the ordinary derivatives. But in Riemann, at the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system, the Christoffel symbol vanishes. So therefore, there, it makes no difference whether we write the commas or the semicolons. So then we write down the equation with the semicolon. Now it's a covariant equation that is guaranteed to hold true in any coordinate system, anywhere. And so every equation like this one that holds for commas also holds for semicolons. Of course, you can't say the other way around, right? But if it holds for commas everywhere, then it's true for for covariant derivatives always. That's just what I wrote here. Okay, so now let's apply this for the metric. And what we have is that the Lie derivative of the metric is a covariant derivative of the metric and then xi plus, and then here the covariant derivatives on the xi. We know that the covariant derivative of the metric is zero. Remember the significance of that statement. This statement, just to remind you, is linking the affine connection, which is hidden here in this nabla. It's linking the affine connection to the metric. This condition made sure that the description of curvature through the Christoffel symbol is the same as the description of curvature through the metric. This is the metric compatibility equation that needs to be obeyed such that the affine connection belongs to the metric and the metric belongs to the affine connection. Now, if we write this out in coordinates, it's of course this statement here. And that tells us that this first term goes away, which is why we are writing this down with semicolons instead of without. Because if it was just the commas, we could not conclude that this term would vanish. It wouldn't, right? But with the semicolons, this term is guaranteed to vanish. So then we are just left with the statement that the vanishing of the Lie derivative of the metric, so the presence of a symmetry, a continuously parameterized symmetry, boils down to the existence of a vector field xi, which obeys that this plus that term is zero. So that this plus that term is zero. And if we pull down, if we use the metric to pull down these indices, then the statement is this one. So what we are looking for when we, let's say you solve the Einstein equation for, I don't know, a black hole where some laser beam is shot in or whatever. Then you may want to know, do I still have conservation laws? Well, then what do you need to do? You already have your metric, right? You have a metric that corresponds to a black hole in the presence of a laser beam that hits the black hole, let's say. And you calculated that, you solved the Einstein equation and whatnot, so you have that metric now. Now you want to know, can I make use of conservation laws when I calculate geodesics or something like that? Then how do you find out whether you have a conservation law? Well, you take your metric or your affine connection and you use it to express that differential equation here. You write down this differential equation for a vector field xi. Right? It's a four-component vector field xi, and you write down the covariant derivative with respect to these coordinates there. And because it's a semicolon, you have Christoffel symbols in here. And so what you need to check is whether given the Christoffel symbols of the space-time that you're interested in, you can find a solution, which is to say a four-vector field psi, which obeys this anti-symmetry condition. If yes, then your space-time has a symmetry. And therefore, we are suspecting that it will have a conservation law. Let's see if it does. So let's assume that the space-time that we're dealing with has a symmetry. So we were able to find a solution to this anti-symmetry condition for the tensor that you get when you differentiate your contravariant field covariantly. Then let's try to identify what it is that is conserved. So we found a solution psi, and remember what that is. The vector field psi, if we use it to define a flow on the manifold, and as a tangent vector field, right? So the any tangent vector field psi can be viewed as defining a flow which is tangent to the tangent vector field, right? Then this Killing vector field condition means that if you consider the metric along that flow, it stays the same, right? So this is the farmer statement, you know, so much milk, so many dollars per liter and whatever, right? So this is that statement. This is a non-trivial physical statement if that holds true, if you find a solution psi. It's that the metric doesn't change if you consider a flow along psi, where the flow could be a translation in time. It could be a translation in space. It could be a rotation. You see, a flow could also indicate a rotation. It could also be a boost. And it could be a mix of all of these things. So what is conserved if we have one of those Killing vector fields psi? So for every symmetry, that is for every Killing vector field psi that a space-time given by a metric and on a manifold possesses, its matter field possesses a conserved quantity, which then which flows according to the vector field p mu. So we define a vector field p mu as the contraction of our t mu nu vector, a t mu nu tensor. Remember, this thing was obtained by differentiating the action with respect to the metric, dividing by square root of g. So we take this t mu nu, this thing that we will later call the stress energy tensor or energy momentum tensor, and contract it with our Killing vector field that gives the direction in which we have a symmetry. Then the quantity that we obtain, this p mu, is a vector which describes the quantity that is conserved. Let's prove this. Let us calculate the divergence of this vector. So we calculate p mu, semicolon, mu. Remember we had that last time, that any such expression, I think the expression that occurred in the previous lecture on Tuesday was that it was a k mu, semicolon, mu. But generally, when you have a contravariant vector field and you have its covariant derivative like this, contracted like that, so very important, you only have one upper index. No extra upper index, no extra lower index. Just have one upper index, and then you contract that with the covariant derivative. Then that thing is actually a divergence. So let's calculate what that is. This expression is, by definition, p mu is the contraction of t mu nu with psi. It's this expression, covariant differential. I just substituted this in here. Now, the covariant derivative is a derivation. So by the Leibniz rule, this is the covariant derivative of the t mu nu times carrying forward the psi plus carrying forward the t mu nu and then covariant differentiating the psi. Now, this expression we just saw is zero. And I made a point of saying what it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean a conservation law in itself, right? Because this thing has an extra index up there. This is not a divergence. The equation that this t mu nu semicolon mu is equal to zero, these are n equations, and remember what they were? They were the statement that we get to choose n arbitrary new coordinates without changing the physics. That was that state. Okay, so that's zero. This first term drops out. But here we have T mu nu being symmetric, a symmetric tensor. And then the psi nu semicolon mu is anti-symmetric. Remember, that was the condition for psi to be a Killing vector field, that it is anti-symmetric. And therefore, we are contracting here an anti-symmetric tensor with a symmetric tensor. And of course, that's zero then. This is where it enters that we have a symmetry, because the symmetry meant that the psi nu semicolon mu is anti-symmetric. If we didn't have a symmetry, they wouldn't be anti-symmetric. This term wouldn't drop out. But as it is, it does drop out, and therefore this divergence is vanishing. Now, when the divergence vanishes, we know from special relativity already, when the divergence vanishes, then we have a conservation law. And as we saw, I think, once before, we also have that. Tuesday, we also calculated a divergence, an integral over divergence there. Even in curved spacetime, we can still integrate up a divergence. So if we take here P mu semicolon mu and integrate that over some region of spacetime, then this is the integral over the divergence of the vector field P. Remember how we did that on Tuesday when we calculated the divergence? We showed that this that the divergence is an. What we did here is we showed that we expressed the divergence in terms of a Lie derivative, and the Lie derivative was the anti-commutator of the d and the del, the d and the I, and then the d applied to of the exterior and the interior derivative, and the d applied to the volume form was vanishing, so the only term that was left was the di, and the id term went away, and then. Using Stokes' theorem, which when applied to a divergence is also called the Gauss theorem, we therefore can reduce this volume integral to a surface integral by dropping the d. So we could, just to remind you, we could drop this, then we would have a d there, right? And by Stokes' theorem, we can drop the d, but then have a del there. So what we see here is that when we integrate the divergence over a volume, that is vanishing. And this is telling us that the flow of the vector field over the surface of our spacetime volume that we pick is vanishing. Okay, so this is the integral over the flow of the P vector field over the surface of that region. And that is vanishing, which means that as much is flowing into the region as is flowing out of it. Okay? This is the conservation law that we have then. It might be a little unfamiliar because it's for a field. Now we will do it for a particle. I mean, you will be probably more familiar with a particle conserving its energy or a particle conserving its momentum. But for fields, it's a flow. You have conservation if as much energy flows into a region, if the total flow is conserved, as much as flows into it has to flow out. Right, and then from now on, we will call the T mu nu, therefore, the energy momentum tensor. Because now we see how we can get energy densities and momentum densities out of it. Namely, we take the T mu nu, just going back for a moment, we take the T mu nu, and we contract it with the Killing vector field. Then we obtain a vector of energy and momentum flow. Now, this was about fields. Let's consider what a Killing vector field tells us about the conservation of energy and momentum of particles that travel on that space-time. So what we just calculated was the energy balance for, let's say, the Klein-Gordon field or for Dirac field or electromagnetism, if they have a certain energy momentum tensor that you can calculate, and you have a Killing vector field, then the statement that we calculated above says that the flow of energy and momentum is conserved along because of these symmetries. Now, what about point particles that travel on geodesics? So let's assume that a space-time possesses a Killing vector field psi. And let's assume we have a point-like particle that travels along a geodesic gamma. So now this is no longer about fields, but particles. Then we obtain a conserved quantity by contracting our Killing vector field, not with the energy momentum tensor, but with the velocity vector of our particle along its geodesic. So the claim now is that this quantity that you obtain by contracting, summing over the Killing vector field with the velocity vector along the geodesic, is a conserved quantity along that trip. It's super useful if you want to calculate the trajectories of rockets, moons, or satellites around space-time. And this quantity might be called the energy or the momentum, depending on whether the Killing vector field is time-like or space-like. Now, in Minkowski space, if we would say that the conserved quantity is the energy, if the psi can be put into the form of a vector 1, 0, 0, and if it can be put into the form by suitable choice of coordinates, 0, 1, 0, 0, then we would call it a momentum. Let's see if we really have conservation of this quantity q. So here's the quantity q, a contraction of psi with the geodesic, with the tangent vector to the geodesic. So gamma of tau is the geodesic. Gamma dot of tau is the tangent vector to the geodesic. Let's give this tangent vector the name u for simplicity, that we don't have to write gamma dot all the time. Then here we have this supposedly conserved quantity, the Killing vector field contracted with the tangent vector. And then we need to differentiate that covariantly in the direction of travel, right? We want to check whether this quantity is conserved as we travel along the geodesic. Now, this is a scalar. We could just do an ordinary derivative there. But if we write it as a covariant derivative, then we can make use of the fact that it is a derivation, and we can work it out in detail then. So let's do this. We differentiate the supposed conserved quantity q in the direction of travel, so the covariant derivative in the direction of the tangent vector u. Now, this is, of course, this u, if spelled out, is a uk multiplied with the basis vectors d by dxk. And the uk coefficients can always be pulled in front. So we do this, so it's a uk, and then the semicolon k's are the remaining covariant differentiations in the directions of the basis vector. And this is just carried forward, we're just here carrying forward the thing that needs to be differentiated. By the Leibniz rule, we have now that the uk is multiplying derivative of this, where we differentiate the first term, leaving the second the same, and here we are leaving the first term and then covariantly differentiating the second term. Now, both of these terms vanish. And here's how to see it. Here we have uk and u mu. That's symmetric. But the x mu semicolon k is anti-symmetric because that's a Killing vector field. And the Killing vector field equation was that this is anti-symmetric. So we are contracting here this anti-symmetric tensor with this symmetric tensor. Therefore, that's vanishing. Now, here we have the covariant derivative of the tangent vector contracted with the tangent vector, tangent to the geodesic. But this is the geodesic equation. But the geodesic equation says that a tangent vector field is the tangent vector field to your geodesic if the tangent vector field doesn't change in the direction pointed out by the tangent vector. So the covariant derivative in the direction of u of u is zero. So therefore, that expression vanishes independently of the xi. So that term is also vanishing. And you see the two ingredients that go into the conservation here. We need both that the path of travel is geodesic. If it were not geodesic, this would not vanish. But we also need that the xi is really killing vector field, because otherwise, if this wasn't anti-symmetric, that might not vanish. OK, so we saw that we get conservation laws for individual particles traveling, but we also got conservation laws for fields and the densities of energy and momentum. Now, important in the conservation laws for the energy and momentum of fields was that this equation holds true. Let's go a bit more into detail for why that equation is true. I already indicated it briefly. Many variations of the metric do not actually change the Riemannian structure. They only boil down to a change of coordinates. And of course, a generic change of the metric will involve both. There will be an unnecessary change of coordinates and a change of the metric, and the two cannot be properly entangled, disentangled from each other. But in particular, there are lots of variations that are purely only changes of coordinates, where the g mu nu of x goes into g tilde mu nu of x, which is additive. So the change is just additive. But that's what we mean by infinitesimal change of the metric. But it doesn't actually change the shape of the manifold, because there is actually an isometric diffeomorphism such that the new metric is the pullback of the old metric. But the energy momentum tensor depends on all of the derivatives, not just the derivatives that actually change the metric. Also, we are also differentiating with respect to those that are merely changes of coordinates. So therefore, we are expecting that T mu nu of x, while containing important physical information, will also contain some redundant information. There's got to be stuff about T mu nu of x that's true no matter what the physics is. There's got to be something needs to be, we need to be able to say something about T mu nu of x that's always true no matter what the space-time is. And that's, of course, this equation over there. And here's how we count that amount of information. It's diffeomorphism invariance that we're dealing with here. So relabeling points going from a coordinate system of untilded coordinates x0 to x3 to tilded coordinates, or barred coordinates, such a diffeomorphism allows us to choose four functions freely, namely the new x0, x1, x2, x3, as functions of the old variables, the old coordinates x0 to x3. Therefore, we expect four equations that express the redundancy in T mu nu of x. And these equations turn out to be these equations. Now, the proof of this is a little tedious, and I thought in the interest of time, I will just sketch how this works. It's actually all spelled out in nitty-gritty in the slides. But there's only so much energy that one has to spend on proofs like this. OK, so how do we start here? Assume that phi index t is a diffeomorphism of the manifold into itself, which is generated by the flow of a vector field xi. And it vanishes outside a region B. So we have some flow inside the region. It's deforming a little bit, but only inside a finite region. Well, let's put it this way, only, I shouldn't have said deform. We are relabeling the events on the spacetime. We're not changing the spacetime. Remember, we are only changing coordinates here. So assume we are changing the coordinates, but only in a finite region of space-time. Outside, we keep the coordinates the same. Inside that region, we compress and rotate and, you know, mess with our coordinate system. Think of your coordinate system as being drawn onto the manifold. And then you grab onto this, these drawings, and you move them a little bit, if that's possible somehow. And without changing the shape of the manifold, you just move a little bit the coordinate system that you drew on it, but locally only. Okay. Now, every integral in general relativity and outside general relativity, any integral stays the same if you reparameterize it, right? If you just change variables in it. And that is also true for the action. The action is an integral. You're integrating a Lagrangian density over space-time. That's what the action is generally. And now you know why we call this a Lagrangian density, right? Because this thing needs to be multiplied with the square root of g in order to get the action. Okay, so the L depends on both psi and the derivatives of psi and on the metric. And psi stands here, again, just like on Tuesday, for the collection of all possible matter and radiation fields. And the statement that we just made is that the action is the same if we change coordinates and calculate it in a different coordinate system. Just always true. But that means that we can put this on the other side, and then we have the difference between L calculated in one coordinate system and L calculated in another one. So if the second coordinate system is obtained from the first by a diffeomorphism of the kind that we just discussed, and we can write it like this, that 0 is the integral over the difference between the two, where this diffeomorphism does the change of coordinates in L. This is true whether or not we divide by the factor t. T is the parameter. It has nothing to do with the time. T, if you remember, was just a parameter for the diffeomorphism. If t is equal to 0, we're not changing coordinates. And then if t gets larger, we are doing a change of coordinates that is generated by the flow of psi. And so the larger the value of t, the further away we flow. OK, but why would we want to divide by t? Well, because then it looks like a Newton-Leibniz derivative, right? A function here, a function there, divided by the difference between the two values, and so we get a derivative. And then we go into, this is the part that I'd like to skip. We work all of this out, and we get the Lie derivative in this at the moment. And then we use the fact that the Lie derivative of the metric takes this form, and then, you know, the Lie derivative of the metric, we had this already today previously. We can write this with the commas. We can write it with the semicolons. If we write it with the semicolons, this term is vanishing. We use that. Then these two terms go into here. And eventually, yeah, it's just tedious. Eventually, after some integration by parts and things, techniques that we all did. There's no new trick in these things. It's just a bunch of them piled up. Integration by parts, throwing away boundary terms. Eventually, we arrive at the statement that we wanted to prove, which is that we have this covariant conservation of the energy momentum tensor, where, remember, the term covariant conservation doesn't mean anything is conserved. We only get actual conservation if there's a Killing vector field. So we get this statement here. So ultimately, what this means is really just that we get to choose other coordinates, and it doesn't change the physics. The statement that any other coordinate system will do too, and the physics doesn't change, is that statement as an equation. which is kind of a generalization of Noether, but it's not the conservation law because it doesn't describe physics. It describes math. It describes the invariance of integrals under changes of variables, and it would be a miracle if that mathematical statement that integrals don't change under changes of variables in which you integrate them, if that had physical consequences such as the conservation of energy or momentum. It doesn't, right? It just means this. It doesn't actually mean conservation of energy and momentum. For that, you actually need a physical observation for this to be true, such as the presence of a symmetry. Okay. So now, how do we actually calculate this all-important quantity T mu nu of x? Remember how it was defined. Initially, we said energy and momentum are ordinarily defined as those quantities that are conserved because we have translation invariance in space and in time. Now, that doesn't work anymore on curved space-time because we don't have these symmetries anymore. Then we said, okay, Noether's theorem uses the action in order to derive in Minkowski space that translation invariance in space and time imply energy and momentum conservation. Therefore, now, to generalize this to curved space-times, let us consider how does the action change as we change the metric. Obviously, the action and the energy momentum must be very sensitive to changes in the space-time. That's why we were interested in differentiating the action with respect to the metric, well knowing that some of these differentiations are spurious. They just amount to change of coordinates. Once we had that derivative, we called this tau and found that thing is not a tensor. So we divided it by square root of g, and then we obtained a tensor, the energy momentum tensor. This thing is going to be important because this is what gravity reacts to. Gravity is not interested in the electromagnetic charge. It's not interested in the strong or the weak charges. Gravity is only interested in this, in the energy momentum tensor, as far as we know. So if you have two objects that have the same energy momentum tensor but totally different charges, gravity doesn't care. Gravity cares only about this. Okay, so how would we calculate the energy momentum tensor? I mean, I haven't shown you yet how gravity cares about this, right? This would be the Einstein equation. It will come up soon. So how do we calculate the energy momentum tensor? Well, let's start with the action. The action is calculated by this integral here. And once we have an explicit Lagrangian of a theory, well, then we just need to do this functional derivative here with respect to variations of the metric. See, this is something entirely new that didn't exist pre-gravity theory. Because pre-gravity, you couldn't differentiate with respect to the metric because the metric was frozen. It was just eta mu nu. And the energy momentum tensor was at the time also defined, but very differently. You remember how you derive it then? It's a different procedure. You derive it from energy and translation invariance, from time and space translation invariance. But here we don't. Here we differentiate with respect to the metric. So let's do this then. What we have to do is differentiate the action with respect to lambda. Remember that this formal expression here is defined by defining variations of g mu nu in terms of a parameter lambda, and then differentiating with respect to the parameter lambda the way we always differentiate. OK, so what we obtain then is that this thing has to be differentiated with respect to lambda. So there are lots of dependencies of lambda in there. We differentiate our L with respect to g mu nu, del g mu nu. That, of course, has a dependence on lambda in it because that's right in there, in the variation of G, A, B. Now, the Lagrangian also depends on the matter fields. Let's differentiate with respect to them, and then we have the variation of the fields. But we are not varying with respect to the field here. We are not varying with respect to the matter fields. We are varying only with respect to the metric. So that actually doesn't contribute. There is no such term. because we decided to functionally differentiate only with respect to the metric, not with respect to the matter fields. I really would not have needed to write this term down. But I wrote it down just for completeness, because there's soon going to be a term that is very similar. Now, first, let's also consider that when we functionally differentiate the action with respect to the metric, we need to be careful that the metric also occurs in here, right? Also in the measure factor. So we have to carry forward the L from here and then differentiate the square root of the absolute value of the determinant of the metric with respect to the metric. And that's a little exercise that I leave to you to show that this is 1/2 GAB square root of G. Okay, so we get this expression plus another term that we may have thought we could neglect, but we cannot. And that's the term where we differentiate the action with respect to the matter fields, covariant derivative, and then do the variation of the matter fields covariant derivative. And naively, we might think, okay, that goes away because we're not varying with respect to the matter fields. Right? If you don't vary with respect to the matter fields, well, this term goes away, right? But this term doesn't. And that's because this is a variation of the covariant derivative of the matter field. And that actually is sensitive to changes of the metric. Not because the matter field is itself sensitive to changes in the metric, but the covariant derivative of it is. Because the covariant derivative of it contains the Christoffel symbols. It contains the curvature information. It contains the metric. So therefore, this expression actually is not vanishing when we differentiate with respect to the metric. OK, so we have these three terms then surviving. OK, here I'm saying that the variation of the covariant derivative of the matter field is not zero, even though the variation of the matter field itself is zero. And that's because the covariant derivative contains the Christoffel symbols. And if the variation in G is not zero, then the variation in the Christoffel symbols is not zero. OK, so what then is the variation of the covariant derivative of the matter field? Well, we can write this out. It's the variation of the matter field with respect to the Christoffel symbol and then the variation of the Christoffel symbol. I remember a little fact that we discussed at the beginning of Tuesday's lecture. We looked at Tuesday's lecture's purpose was to study how all kinds of matter fields evolve on a curved space-time. And before we even started looking at Klein-Gordon field or a matter field like a fermion field or electromagnetism, before that, we asked a little question. We asked, could it be that one of the other fields is not a regular boson or fermion, not a regular kind of matter or radiation field? Maybe we have another gravity too, another Christoffel symbol, right? And then we discussed that if you have a theory of two Christoffel symbols, the difference between the two is a tensor. And the difference between two Christoffel symbols is a tensor. And so we said that if you have a theory with two gravities, with two affine connections, it is perfectly legal to say you have a theory with just one gravity, one affine connection, plus a tensor field. Tensor field that is the difference between the two affine connections. And that makes it an ordinary matter field again. OK, but the point that we need now is that a variation of an affine connection is actually tensorial. Remember that the affine connection itself is not a 1-2 tensor. It's not a one-fold contravariant, two-fold covariant tensor. It doesn't transform right. But the variation, or the difference between two of them, is tensorial. And the reason is that the offending term, the term that prevents the tensorial properties, is not dependent on the Christoffel symbol itself. So in a difference taking between any two of them, this offending term goes away. OK, so then the variation is a tensor, and the variation of the Christoffel symbol can be calculated. It's a few lines, but again, maybe a little too tedious. It is given in this way. remember, if we drop this and that and that and that, then it's a known equation for an equation that we had before between how to express the Christoffel symbol in terms of the metric, and the first order derivative just gives you this term here. Easy to prove if you just look at it in a geodesic coordinate system. And from that, we can then work out what the variation is of the covariant derivative of a matter field. Again, you know, this is this surprising piece that the variation of the matter field vanishes if we differentiate with respect to the metric, if we vary the metric. But the variation of the covariant derivative of a matter field is non-zero when we vary the metric, because the metric goes into here, because of this going and producing a variation of the Christoffel symbol that's sitting in there, and that's the expression that we get. So then, what we can do is we can take this crucial piece, that this extra term that we had there, you know, this one, and it has here this semicolon, and we can do an integration by parts. As we always do in these calculations, so that at the end of the day, we get just a variation of the metric again, and not a derivative of it. How that looks like in practice depends very much on what theory you work with, what Lagrangian it is. But at the end of the day, you have that the variation is something, something, depending on the case, times the variation of the metric. And then you can read off. Then you get something which is of the form ds by d lambda equal to integral, something complicated, and then variation of the metric square root of g d4x. And at that point, you can read off that whatever that is complicated stuff in the concrete case, is the T mu nu, is the energy momentum tensor. Let's do this explicitly. That's probably more enlightening than just talking about it in the abstract. Very important case, Klein-Gordon field. Here's the action for the Klein-Gordon field. We have the derivative of the Klein-Gordon field, derivative of the Klein-Gordon field, and then contracted. This is the kinetic term of the Klein-Gordon field. In Minkowski space, this would be ordinary derivatives. And with an integration by parts, you can turn this into psi, D'Alembertian psi. So up to integration by parts, this is just the expression psi, D'Alembertian psi. psi is a scalar, and so you could actually write this with ordinary derivatives there. And then we have possibly also a potential for our scalar field that will play a role in cosmology later on, that we have a potential there. So-called inflaton field has a potential. And that potential could be, for example, a psi to the 4 potential. So this could be having a quadratic term, something with m squared psi squared, and another term that might be lambda psi to the 4th, for example. OK, so if this is the action, we already know how to derive the equation of motion, which is the Klein-Gordon equation. But what we want to know is, how does this field, how does such a field curve space-time? And as an intermediate step, we need to calculate what is the energy momentum tensor for this field. Once we know that, we can then later plug that into the Einstein equation to find out how this field affects curvature. OK, so we differentiate our action with respect to the metric in order to obtain the energy momentum tensor. So we do these derivatives. We have to differentiate the metric here. We get the variation of the metric. Remember, this term is multiplied with square root of g, and that term is multiplied with square root of g. So we get a bunch of terms here. So we get this variation here, and then we get a term where all of this is left the same, and then we are varying only the square root of g with respect to the metric. And then we get a term where we have the potential multiplied with square root of g, differentiated with respect to the metric, and only this part has the metric in it. So we get potential and then that derivative. Remember that from the exercise of two slides before, the derivative of the square root of the metric with respect to the metric is 1/2 gij square root of g. Another trick that we need for these calculations is that when you contract the metric with itself, so that you get one lower and one upper index, then what you get is the delta, is the Kronecker delta, right? So g mu nu with lower indices, and then you have the nu alpha with upper indices gives you a Kronecker delta. And the Kronecker delta is, of course, a constant, and therefore the variation of it is vanishing. But that means that by the Leibniz rule, we have that g times del g plus del g times g with the respective index structure is vanishing. That helps us because it allows us to move upper and lower indices around, which we need because these guys have lower indices and this thing has upper indices. So we need that equation to move them down. So therefore, we can collect everything together and obtain this expression here for the derivative of the action with respect to the metric. And now, all we need to do is collect the terms. So we have, look at the structure of this. The structure of this is that the derivative of the action with respect to lambda is given by something times delta gij plus something else, delta gij plus something else, delta gij. Altogether, this thing is of the structure that it's the integral over something times delta gij. And that something is then our energy momentum density. And we can read it off what it is. It is this expression. Energy momentum tensor density is this expression. Up to a square root of g, it is the energy momentum tensor. So the energy momentum tensor at the end is this one. The energy momentum tensor for the Klein-Gordon field, which is super important for cosmology, has this kinetic term where we have the derivative, the space and time derivatives of our field. Another term with the space and time derivatives of the field. And then this potential term, where cosmologists have another weird terminology. Remember that for cosmologists, everything that's not gravity is called matter, including light, called matter for cosmologists. Now, cosmologists will also use this weird terminology where mass belongs to the potential. So this potential term here, as we saw earlier, can contain both a quadratic term and a term, let's say, to the fourth power, but it could be really any arbitrary potential. My point is that ordinarily in particle physics, in quantum field theory for particle physics, for example, the quadratic term would be taken out of the potential and called part of the kinetic part. But cosmologists bunch them together with the other terms. Okay, now this expression is a symmetric tensor, manifestly, because this is symmetric and under change of mu and nu, and so is this, and that's a scalar anyway. So the whole thing is symmetric from the start. If you remember from how in classical mechanics the energy momentum tensor is derived, it's canonically not symmetric in mu and nu. You have to arrange that it becomes symmetric. Here it comes out symmetric simply because it arises from the differentiation of the action with respect to the metric, which is symmetric. OK, then let me also show you the energy momentum tensor for the electromagnetic field. In principle, you can derive this now with the same tricks. The energy momentum tensor for the electromagnetic field is given by this expression. Now, another super important case is the case of a perfect fluid. Now, what is a perfect classical fluid for a cosmologist? You see, in classical theory, a perfect fluid could also be one that is having a thermodynamically reversible dynamics. But this is not how cosmologists see it. Cosmologists define a perfect classical fluid to be any fluid whose energy momentum tensor takes this particular form. So what this means is, for a cosmologist, a perfect fluid is a fluid which has at every point in space and time a unique flux direction vector. You could imagine, for example, a fluid of the following form. You could have, let's say you could be outdoors, and outdoors some wind is always going on. So you have this fluid of the air going around, and it has its velocity. But you may also have some smoke. Let's say you have a cigarette, and the smoke goes up. This is, the smoke particles may not have the same trajectory as the air particles have. And so you have two flows going to each, through each other. Right? That would not be a perfect fluid. So a perfect fluid is the simplest kind of fluid. And it is characterized by having just a local energy density and a local pressure. And you don't need anything else to describe it. So the energy momentum tensor for a perfect fluid is described by the unique vector field of the flow together with the energy density and the pressure. We are here working with the signature of the metric, where the metric has signature minus 1, 1, 1, 1. If you go to the rest frame of one of those particles of the fluid, then this velocity vector, this four velocity vector, is not zero, right? If you go to the rest frame, what is the velocity vector? The four velocity vector of a particle at rest? Yeah, exactly. Because it's still moving in time, right? It's sitting still in space, but its velocity in time is one. It's just moving forward in time. So what we have here is that there's only a zero, zero component. And that means we have only a T naught naught here. This contributes only to the T naught naught. And the contribution is mu plus P. But there is a minus one from the G naught naught term, which gets rid of that P, and we're just left with the mu. Okay? So it's simply saying that in the rest frame, the energy density is mu. And then if you choose to work in another coordinate system, then you also get the pressure. It's just like an electric field can look like a magnetic field, a magnetic field can look like an electric field just by Lorentz transformation. So similarly, energy can look like momentum, etc. That's what you have here. And then the special case would be, for example, the case of pressureless dust, which would travel on geodesics. And it turns out that the geodesic equation for pressureless dust is then simply this one. But that's a coincidence, the covariant conservation there. OK, so cosmologists call any fluid that has this energy momentum tensor a perfect fluid. By the way, why would cosmologists be interested in dust? Isn't that something that vacuum cleaners should care about? Well, it's because in cosmology, the idea of a pressureless gas of dust particles is actually very accurately describing the situation in the universe. But what are the dust particles for the cosmologist?
Galaxies?
Yes. Every galaxy is a dust particle. Yeah. So you can imagine how many galaxies.
Yeah.
Mind-blowing. OK, so then the equation of state, it's just a matter of terminology. This is not mathematically deep. This is the mathematically lowest thing you will have ever seen in this course. It's a so-called equation of state. The equation of state for a perfect fluid is simply to be defined the relationship between its energy density mu and its pressure p. It's just the ratio of the two. So by definition, we take the pressure of a perfect fluid and divide it by its energy density. And that quantity is simply defined to be W. W is the equation of state parameter, called the equation of state parameter. Keep that thing in mind. It's the ratio of pressure over energy density. The equation of state parameter W for a gas of galaxies, every galaxy is just a grain of dust. What is the equation of state parameter for that? Zero, right? Because there's no pressure. You don't have that these galaxies collide, they just float. So the equation of state parameter for perfect fluid is the ratio of pressure over energy density, a super important quantity. You will see that quantity being discussed in virtually every cosmology lecture, cosmology research talk. And I will tell you in a moment why that is. So here's how it starts, why that is important. Let us look at the energy momentum tensor that we calculated for the Klein-Gordon field. And remember Klein-Gordon field as an example, it could be the Higgs particle of the standard model. It's described by a Klein-Gordon equation, but also the inflaton field of cosmology will be described by the Klein-Gordon equation. We will see much more about the inflaton field soon. So here's the Klein-Gordon equation describing the Higgs and the inflaton field. And in fact, they may be the same. The Higgs and the inflaton field may still be the same. Doesn't look too good for that equivalence, but there's still a chance that they might actually turn out to be the same field. And then we have the energy momentum tensor of a perfect fluid. It looks like this. At first sight, this looks a little different from that. But actually, they're quite similar if you look at them closely. The energy momentum tensor for the electromagnetic field is very different. But these two are quite similar. And here's how you see that they're similar. Basically, what we have is a vector and the same vector. And then we have the metric times the scalar. Okay? That's the structure here, too. We have a vector times a vector, and then the metric times the scalar. Okay? We have that in both cases. And we can calculate what that vector would be. So what about this? Basically, you can see already how the match would be, right? So we can match this scalar to that and these vectors to this. And what that means is that in certain circumstances, we can view the behavior of a Klein-Gordon field, such as the inflaton field or the Higgs field, as being very similar, gravitationally speaking, as far as gravity is concerned, to the behavior of a perfect fluid. And in particular, we can assign an energy density and a pressure to the Klein-Gordon field by comparison with the perfect fluid. You could say this matches in structure that, and therefore certain coefficients here and there match the coefficients there and there, mu and p, and therefore we get an equation of state parameter. So we can calculate an equation of state parameter for the energy momentum tensor here. And you see, this is going to be a field, quantum field eventually, and it has a highly non-trivial dynamic. And that dynamics could lead to an equation of state parameter that could be zero, that could be negative, that could be positive. All sorts of things can happen. And modern cosmology is built on the observation that the behavior of this energy momentum tensor is very close to the behavior of this one. We can define an energy density and the pressure and an equation of state parameter. And the analysis of this matches closely the analysis of that as far as gravity is concerned. And in particular, the initial explosive inflation of space-time can be explained in terms of the evolution of the equation of state parameter that you can define for the Klein-Gordon field in comparison to that of the perfect fluid. Just because gravity really doesn't distinguish between the two. Just a matter of renaming the coefficients in front. But both equations simply have vector times vector and then metric times a scalar. So let's work that out. Almost done. Okay. So let's assume that psi, our Klein-Gordon field, is almost homogeneous. What does it mean that the field is homogeneous? It means that it's translation invariant. It's constant in space. The inflaton field is a field that, apart from quantum fluctuations, is assumed to be constant in space. We will later see why that is. Let me just tell you. Okay. At the beginning of the universe, the inflaton field and the metric might have been crumpling, right? Like a balloon. When it's deflated, it's crumpling. And then you blow it up, and what happens is that it flattens out, right? And the same phenomenon, with some subtleties, is thought to have happened at the beginning of the universe. The metric might have been super complicated. The inflaton field might have been super complicated. But once you get a dramatic expansion, it flattens things out. And so it will be a very good approximation to make that the inflaton field, along with many other fields, were basically homogeneous. Basically, the derivative, the spatial derivatives, this is not a J, this is a semicolon. A semicolon I is about zero. So the spatial derivatives of the Klein-Gordon field are basically zero. It's very important that it's not exactly zero, and it will be quantum fluctuations that cannot be suppressed that will resist the flattening through the expansion. And these quantum fluctuations make inhomogeneities, so the universe expansion makes everything flat, and then quantum fluctuations imprint some inhomogeneities there. And these inhomogeneities are the ones that we now see in the cosmic microwave background, which are now thought to have seeded the collapse of the primordial gas into galaxies and stars, and ultimately us. So you see, there were two things competing. One was the flattening, so the expansion, and the other one was the quantum fluctuations. And in this course, we will do the flattening. And in the next course, we will do the, next term, we will do the quantum fluctuations to calculate then how the inhomogeneities were imprinted. Anyway, so we assume the psi is almost homogeneous, almost constant in space. Then we match the parameters between those two equations. And obviously, we have that the velocity is given by the covariant derivative of psi divided by this factor just to make the two equations match. So the Klein-Gordon equation can be written in this way. Just by matching the two equations, matching the coefficients, by choosing this velocity vector to be that. Of course, the Klein-Gordon field isn't really a fluid, but we can assign a v vector in this way, and then the energy momentum tensor of the Klein-Gordon field can be expressed in the same way as that of a perfect fluid, with velocity vector, some stuff in front, and then we have the metric tensor and the scalar. And then from that, we can read off what the mu and the p are. Because this expression has to be the mu plus p. And that expression has to be the p. So if we calculate the ratio between the two, then we get what is 1 over w plus 1. So there's a little algebra in here. And at the end, we can calculate what the equation of state parameter is of the Klein-Gordon field, under the assumption that the Klein-Gordon field is spatially almost constant because the initial expansion made it flat. Flattened everything, the metric and the fields. Under this assumption, we have no longer any space derivatives in psi, but we only have the time derivatives in psi. OK, so now this is the equation of state parameter here. And that's a super important quantity. Let us look at this. It has a kinetic term. Basically, it has the rate of change of the Klein-Gordon field over time. And it has the potential. Potential of the Klein-Gordon field. But it has, crucially, different signs here in the denominator and in the numerator. And what this means is that there is a special behavior when the potential is very large. See, if the potential is very large, then that equation of state parameter can go negative, right? So if the field doesn't change all that quickly, and the potential is very, very large, then, well, basically this quantity is much larger than that, and that quantity is much larger than that. So therefore, we can neglect these two terms, and we just get minus V over V. So if the potential, for whatever reason, if the potential of the inferton field is very, very large, of Klein-Gordon field in general, very, very large, the equation of standard parameter goes to minus 1, which, if you think about it, is super weird. Because what is the equation state parameter? It's the pressure divided by the energy density, right? How can that be negative? How could the pressure divided by the energy density ever be negative? You see, the energy density better be positive. So we would have negative pressure. What is that, a negative pressure? Ordinary matter doesn't have negative pressure. And what do you have to do to a gas to make it have negative pressure? It always has positive pressure. But the Klein-Gordon field can have negative pressure. And as we will later see, negative pressure is something that gravity cares about. If once we plug that into the Einstein equation, we will find that negative pressure means that space-time wants to expand. In fact, exponentially fast. And what that tells us is that there's a mechanism by which the universe might have started, as we will see later on in more detail. Namely, imagine you have a universe like ours, in which there are Klein-Gordon fields around. For example, the Higgs particle, or for example, the inflatron field. These fields always quantum fluctuate. And ordinarily, quantum fluctuations of fields are not observable by the naked eye. Right? We don't see them just happening, quantum fluctuations of a field. They're rare. You can calculate them, and they're rare. In order to see a quantum fluctuation of any significant size, you have to look at really small scales. The smaller the scale, the more the quantum fluctuations become prominent. At really, really small scales, you can get really large quantum fluctuations. They're very important there, for example, when you do accelerator experiments and so on. And quantum fluctuations are really important. Also, when you do high accuracy measurements of the hydrogen atom, for example, the spectroscopy, in order to get predictions, theoretical predictions to match with experiments to 12 digits behind the comma, you need to take into account quantum fluctuations of the field. Very, very importantly there. So ordinarily, quantum fluctuations are not a big deal. They're not that important. But they can happen at any size, anywhere, all the time. It's just that they're very unlikely to happen in a large scale. But what this is telling us is that if by chance, somewhere in the universe, like our universe, if by chance there is a patch of the universe where just randomly, out of the blue, the field psi, the inflaton field, fluctuates so that locally it happens to have a large energy, a really large one, so that it dominates over that psi dot. So if the inflaton field in a patch is spatially relatively constant, so that we don't need to take into account the spatial derivatives, also not changing all that fast, but fluctuates to very large values, so that the potential is really large up here and down there, then this can locally, in that patch where these quantum fluctuations happen, there it can lead to locally a negative pressure. And if the V is large enough, not even the Planck scale, but you have to go almost to the Planck scale. But if it's really large, then you get close to minus 1 here. And then the Einstein equations, as we will see, kick in and inflate the space-time. And it mushrooms out. It can, within like 10 to the minus 29 seconds, generate a universe, right? Like gazillions of light years across, which means our universe is unstable. If we indeed have a scalar field that has a potential, our universe is not stable, because there is a finite probability that anywhere, at any time, this could happen, that from our universe, a daughter universe will be spawned just by this phenomenon. Of course, I'm anticipating a lot of stuff. We haven't seen exactly yet why a negative equation of state parameter will lead to an exponential expansion and all that, but we will see that. I just wanted to anticipate so that you see the significance of this stuff already. But what have we done so far? We've only calculated how matter fields behave on a curved space-time, how their equation of motion is influenced, like the Dirac equation on Tuesday, how it's impacted by the curvature of space-time. Now we've calculated energy momentum tensors for this matter field. And so next we can then calculate how these energy momentum tensors affect space-time. How matter is not only affected by space-time, but how matter, through its energy momentum tensor, is affecting space-time. We get the Einstein equation, and then we can look at the interplay of both of them. Because we can't just assume the space-time and then see what matter does. We can't just assume that matter does this and then calculate what space-time does. We have to solve the equations of motion of both of them simultaneously to get cosmological solutions. Anyway, so now we have a bit of the energy momentum tensors. Okay. See you on Tuesday.